Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. And as we kind of dive into the Constitution again, because we're not done, what we want to do is we want to cover some really key things. But before we do, that debt is fraud, and we want to make sure that if you're so inclined, please make sure you continue your prayers and your spiritual tools that you have in your tool belt so that we can call upon, make an appeal to heaven to give us aid and comfort in these trials of reclaiming the Republic. But more importantly, we got Tammy back with us. Welcome back, Tammy.
Thank you.
And on top of that, what we have left out of the Constitution, because technically we already covered the progressive amendments, and there are a few more amendments, but most of them are really administrative. Now, we dealt with one, actually we dealt with two amendments. We covered the, what was it, the 15th and the 19th. And so there is, I believe it's the 24th and the 26th that we need to cover still. And so let's dive into the 16th first. So the 16th amendment. Not the 16th. I said the 15th. It should be the 15th. So the 15th Amendment, right? This is the first amendment where Congress basically, or the Constitution, dictated the rights of the people for voting. In other words, prior to this, the states had their own mechanism, and most all states used poll taxes, which means that if you had money to pay your property tax, you could vote. There had been, and this was the paradigm, this was the way you would voluntarily participate. But the federal government saw the poll tax, and this comes in much later, but the poll tax was a mechanism of the state making money. It was a key part of the property tax. Prior to that, again, it was not compulsory.
So you just didn't get a vote.
Yeah, you just didn't get, you couldn't engage in your government process. Correct. And so over time, governments become more and more greedy for money. So they, create a permanent tax on this and that. And, this is why when you look at the East Coast, have you traveled to the East Coast?
Yeah, I used to live there.
Okay, so you know about toll roads. I mean, toll roads are a huge part of the East Coast, and they have been imported into the West Coast now as well, because from Washington down into California, there are many places where they call them express lanes. And this is a sham that the state has pulled, because they say, we don't have the money to create this highway, so we're going to create a toll road. And it becomes a permanent tax, because it's not like they said, okay, this is all the money we need to make to do this. This becomes a permanent tax because the intent behind these toll roads, these express lanes, is to provide traffic relief for those who have money that will be willing to get through traffic faster. Yeah. And I mean, how insidious is that? The reality is that they're taking an area, the existing road, and they're widening it. It's not like they're, forging through, the forest and the mountains and rock and granite, digging tunnels, because there's no way, a right-of-way already created. They're taking an existing highway and just expanding it, which the cost of doing that is far less than literally going and carving out a new road. The engineering, most of the engineering has already been done on the existing road. And so they make it seem like, we went and had to create a whole new road, like all roads are equal, and they're not. So the East Coast, and now it's been imported to the West Coast, eventually will get to a point where if you want to use the road, you're going to have to pay a tax. Or I should say, a toll. Especially if you don't want to be stuck in traffic. Anyway, the election petitions, getting back to these, the election petitions or the voter right petitions are amendments, not petitions. The voter right amendments are amendments that guarantee specific things cannot be abridged. In other words, you can't lose your voting right because of race or ethnicity or your condition of servitude, and or you cannot be denied your right to vote because of sex. You cannot be denied your right to vote because of a poll tax as well as age. So let's really quickly look at what the real caveat is. Because if we look at the 15th Amendment, it's just the first few words. What is it that it says?
The right of the citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude.
Okay, so the rights of the citizens of the United States shall not be abridged. So up until that point, if you're not a citizen, you don't even have a right to vote. This is in 1870 when it was ratified. So the next one that we dive into is going to be the 19th Amendment. And it starts the same way. The right of the citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. There you go. So now they've basically caveated that the only people that have a right to vote are those United States citizens, and you cannot have that right abridged because of sex or because of race. Now, the next one is, I think it's the 24th. And so I'll let you get this one.
The right of citizens of the United States to vote in any primary or other election for president or vice president, for electors for president or vice president. Oh, wait, that was just a repeat. Or for senator or for representative in Congress shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state by reason of failure to pay any poll tax or other tax.
Okay, so this one's interesting. What is interesting about this? It does say that only U.S. citizens are protected, but it basically is pointing to primary and general elections that have federal ramifications. In other words, if you're going to be going to the poll to vote, in other words, the states could actually have two ballots. The states could give you a federal ballot so that everybody could vote in the federal ballot. Then they can have a state ballot, and then what they can do is they can actually parse the line and say, hey, if you haven't paid your poll tax, then you can't vote in the state. You have a right to vote in the federal, but you don't have a right to vote in the state if you do not pay your poll tax or your property tax. Do you see that? Because it says right here that to vote in a primary or other election for president or vice president, for electors for president or vice president, or for senator or representative in Congress shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state by the reason of failure to pay a poll tax. It doesn't say anything about your state governor, your state commissioners, your county commissioners, anything regarding your state. In other words, if the election is a state election, they can hold you to a poll tax. I said this before, but I didn't think it sunk in, but now it does sink in, right? In other words, there's no reason why the state does not imply voluntary property tax. Going back to voluntary property tax, because bottom line, you know, because what we have to do is we've got to get the states ability to seize your land because you don't pay your property tax. That is repugnant. It's one thing that you can't participate in voting in the state for your own representatives and so forth. But it's another thing to say that, we, you know, because you can't even make a tax payment, we're taking your property. So I believe that there's no reason why states cannot make their local and state elections tied to voluntary taxation. But we got to get rid of the ability for them to say, you owe us your property if you can't pay us.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So, okay. So, but the point again, the right of citizens of the United States. And now we go to the last one, which is actually the 26th. And it says, I'll let you read it.
25, 26. Proposed the right of citizens of the United States who are 18 years of age or older to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of age.
Right. So, in other words, the age threshold is 18. And so they went from 21, because the standard right to vote was 21 years of age. And why? Because most people by that point in time were through with their wasting time in academia. And so now that you've got a job, you're basically considered a full-fledged citizen, you know, because you're paying taxes and those types of things. Because this is in 71. And so college was a, you know, kind of a really elite, you know, not a lot of people went to college back in then. Not like today, where every kid goes to college to become a YouTube videographer, director, what have you. So, I mean, completely worthless degrees. So the fact is that when they lowered it to the age of 18, what they did was they injected this, I'll just say this, young group of radical voters, because the kids that were coming out of school in the 70s were radicalized. They weren't radicalized
as they are now.
Correct. It's only gotten worse. They've been getting better and better at weaponizing our children. Now, mm-hmm. There's merit in this, and I'm not prepared to dive into it, but there is a link that actually gives you a look of the kids in our public school system, how many there are. And I think I've talked about this before, but I really need to pull it up so I could show you. That way you can actually see how many kids are graduating from high school this year and how many graduated last year, the year before, the year before, and the year before since the last presidential election. Why is this information important? Because what that does is it shows you how many naive, brainwashed voters will be entering into the election cycle. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And so now you can kind of look moving forward, what is it going to be like in 2028 based on how many kids are graduating out of the public school system? You cannot tell me that that does not have an effect. It's a long time for kids to finally wake up and realize that, you know, all of this allegedly free stuff really affects their bottom line. You know, because it's an eye-opening experience when a kid gets their job and they, you know, get their first paycheck and then they want to know who this FICA is.
Yeah,
who's this FICA? You know, why is he getting so much money? And then Social Security. And then they don't even realize on the flip side of Social Security that for his employment, his employer has to pay out of his pocket, which affects his bottom line because it's directly associated to his wages, that he has to pay another 7.5% on the Social Security as well. So as you know, as we look at how our election system goes, the states would be very wise, the people would be very wise to actually start creating buffers for their election processes. I truly believe that if you are voting on an issue that regards taxation on property, you have to own property. The only reason that we've gotten into this mess where they can steal your property because you can't pay taxes is because they allowed non-tax owner or non-property owners to be able to vote in those elections to say, yeah, we don't care. It doesn't affect us. We know it really does. They're very naive. They're very stupid to think it doesn't affect them. But bottom line, it's all about taking from those who have to give to those who have not, because they believe that the more they tax property, the better it'll be for them with a handout so that they can afford to buy property. And you know what? They never get there. They don't realize that they can't get there as long as they're staying on the end of handouts. You have to realize that receiving free cheese is not how you, make cheese.
Mm-hmm.
You have to learn to make cheese so that you don't have to worry about receiving cheese. And kids are just way too afraid. It's like going to an ice skating rink where everybody is stuck holding on to the rail around the outside. And the few people that are in the center, they're just having a ball because they're doing Olympic twirls and all sorts of stuff because they know how to skate. And they're not afraid to get away from the government prop, the support. Anyway. Okay, so that covers the election amendments. When we look at most of the other amendments, they were either ideological, because there was a progressive amendment. We already kind of covered it. It was the one that was proposed in 1972, was the Equal Rights Amendment. Basically, equal rights, because I'm reading it right here, equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. The Congress shall have the power to enforce the appropriate legislation. In other words, they wanted to make it so you could not discriminate in any way regarding sex. And so it, like all things being equal. Now everybody believes that all things are equal. Well, I should say everybody used to believe that until lately. The progressives have actually gotten their way, and they actually started allowing transgendered men, or whatever you want to call them, compete in women's sports. And now everybody's saying, hey, we're not equal.
Yeah.
Or I should say, more people are realizing the truth is that we aren't equal. Now, the idea that all people, all labor is equal is contrary to the facts. And it is the source of this goes all the way back to Plato and actually the modern day drivel, the modern day proposing or the proffering. Those who proffered this was Engels and Marx, because Marx clearly stated that there is no difference in labor. It doesn't matter how much you do or what you do. It's all equal, and that everybody should be paid equally. And so
I'm going to labor sitting on the couch eating potato chips.
Yeah, so that's right. You're cleaning the bowl. There's some potato chips in that bowl, and somebody's got to do the dirty job of cleaning it up. And so all labor is equal. And the argument is basically the person that, is the janitor or, custodian, whatever, the person that cleans the facilities is equal to the brain surgeon. The person that you actually, trust your life with, that saves your life. The guy that, you come in practically dead and puts you back together and you live, a normal life for the next 30, 40 years. So all labor is not equal. Yeah, there's factors of education. There are skills. There is strength, capacity, there's brain thinking. And so depending
on the time it takes to develop the skill.
Correct. Correct. Now, it's one thing if an employer has blinders on so that they don't see, the gender, the race, these demographics. If we blinded ourselves from demographics and only hired people based on their capacity, their capabilities, and those types of things, they would still not be happy because the lazy would never be able to produce. The kids that didn't care about learning in school and now they want a job and they're entitled.
Yeah.
They didn't apply themselves. At some point in time, you have to apply yourself or you do without. The consequences of our behavior, this goes down that old path. You hear me say this all the time. When society takes all of the effort that it does in removing the consequences of your bad decisions, then all it's doing is enabling more bad decisions. In other words, enabling sin.
Yeah.
Because it's a sin for a person to subside on the efforts and labor of another person. It is tantamount to slavery.
I mean, isn't that communism?
Well, so it is a denial of one of the first commandments of God. You know, I don't like going into the scriptures, but bottom line, the first commandment, when Adam and Eve were cast out, one of the first commandments is that man must live by the sweat of his brow. So those who became slaves to support, this person that didn't want to work so hard, that person that didn't want to work so hard is living in sin because he's not living by his own work and becoming self-sufficient. There's nothing more important in society than everybody being self-sufficient. And there's probably no greater feeling of accomplishment for a child, and these are some of the most important lessons a child can learn, that they earned money so that they could go buy something that they really want, so that they can learn their lesson on foolish spending versus wise spending, saving money, and developing wealth. Because the child that learns those lessons actually learns to discipline themselves. They learn to do without, and discipline is one of the key factors of enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
For us to become an enlightened society, we all have to put aside our differences and our interests by using discipline, and you basically contribute and try to contribute to the best of your ability. If everybody is doing that, how bad would the society be? If everybody was doing their best of their ability in contributing and actually trying to be productive and helping others and so forth, I mean, it's almost like a utopian or altruistic paradigm. So we still got a few more amendments to go through, but moving away from the election ones, the first one I really want to cover is the District of Columbia, and it is Article 23, or actually the 23rd Amendment. And so what we want to do is dive into this. And we covered this already in the ratification debates this past summer. But what we want to do is we want to look at this amendment and how this amendment truly defies the whole intent of the federal government and having its autonomy from the states and the union, because it is there to serve, not to become an equal party to. So let's go ahead and start off with, now when we come back from this promo, let's go ahead and start off with Section 1. Because, and like I said, we talked about this in the ratification, but it's not you and I, but Paul and I. And it was very, very clear that they did not want the federal government to have any involvement in being a state or to have the autonomy that the state has and that sovereignty. Its job was to protect the union and protect the states, not itself. In other words, it was a creature that was created to serve the parties, not itself. And so it was never to develop its ability to amass land, wealth, or anything like that. Everything it did and its whole purpose was to serve. So, like I said, we're going into a break right now. So when we come back, we'll dive into this amendment. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so are you there? Are you on the 23rd Amendment?
I am.
Okay. Now, we could go through all of the amendments, but folks, when you start looking at them, this is one of those amendments that literally changes the fundamental design of the republic. Now, the previous amendments, when we really look at those, most of those were either a contribution of the progressive amendments and or like the one before this was the one that basically said you can only serve two terms. In other words, that was an administrative amendment. We could dive into that, but it really doesn't have an effect on our everyday lives. Now we could get, you know, wonky and talk about, you know, how a person could actually serve more than 8 years and so forth. But when we look at that amendment and we look at, what is the 20th Amendment, I think? The 20th Amendment talks about changing, you know, the meetings and sessions and so forth, because prior to, if I remember correctly, the inauguration would be in March and they moved it up to January so that it would end aligned with the fiscal year. There'd be more of a feeling that when we end 1 year, we start the new. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they just kind of, it's like daylight savings time. You make that one adjustment and you live with it and then you make it back. But in this particular case, it was a one-time adjustment. So most of the amendments, the reason I don't want to cover them is because they just make some changes that, not that they're not important, they really don't affect us. And so you'll notice that these parts, I don't even spend much time on whether they're violating these or not, because these are just perfunctory amendments. Mm-hmm. Just like the 25th Amendment is one that talks about the incapacity or the cognitive ability and or the craziness and the ability for the president to serve and what to do about that. Now, that may seem kind of interesting, and we all really kind of dove into the 25th Amendment over the past 4 years because we actually had a president that was incapable of serving. And we were an embarrassment to the world on that, but I'm going to bypass that. Because what we need to do when we're done, and we'll probably pick this up tomorrow if we get to it then, not today, is the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions. We're going to go back to that. Remember, that's what we were reading before we dove into the Constitution, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. So as we look at these articles, Article 23 or the 23rd Amendment is what they call them. Go ahead and read Section 1.
The district constituting the seat of government of the United States shall appoint in such manner as the Congress may direct a number of electors of president and vice president equal to the whole number of senators and representatives in Congress to which the district would be entitled if it were a state, but in no event more than the least populous state. They shall be in addition to those appointed by the states, but they shall be considered for the purpose of the election of president and vice president to be electors appointed by a state and shall meet in the district and perform such duties as provided by the 12th article of amendment.
Okay, so in other words, they wanted to give the people who chose to live next to the kitchen. Why does somebody like living next to the kitchen? Any idea?
Yeah, because that's where the food is.
That's where you get the crumbs. Right. I mean, they always say the closer you are to the kitchen, the better you are fed. And so it is no surprise that we have a lot of people who don't want to work. They want to, you know, be a part of the bureaucracy. They don't really produce anything. They're a part of the taking. As government gets bigger and bigger, they got to have people that go, you know, somebody's got to go buy the pencils. Somebody's got to get out there and pick up all the administrative needs. I mean, you grow in the, I'll just say, if you want to call it superfluous, it's not. It is, you know, the need. And how much does a government employee make for the guy that actually has to go, you know, somebody that sits there and buys all the supplies online, you know, I forget what they call those out of the GSA and so forth, but how much they make? They're probably making six-digit figure of a salary, and $100,000 or not more.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if they've been there a while and all they're doing is ordering office supplies or what have you. So we start realizing that this is a great opportunity. It's not hard work. Anybody can do it. And we start looking at, okay, well, why is it that these people move there? Because it's an easy job and it becomes a part of their culture. Because if you look at the DC metropolis, this is a metropolis that has never felt the pinch of a downturn housing market. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I had to sneeze. So when we look at these people that moved to D.C., how many years did they live there without the ability? In other words, it was built into the Constitution. You were not to have equal footing with the parties. You were not to have say on your representation. You are void of this. You are no man's land. You are the seat of the general government. You are not to be a state. You are not to have the ability to amass wealth and these types of controls. And so this is almost 200 years, just shy of 200 years. The people that lived in D.C. were not able to contribute in the electoral process because the president, as well as Congress, as well as the Supreme Court, were to represent the parties, not itself. When you allow when you allow a service entity that is designed to serve you the ability to serve itself, now you've created a little bit of competition, and it's not good competition. So they went down this path, and America was stupid enough because by this time in the 1960s, it was all about what type of government. You got these different types of government, right? A Republican form of government, a monarchical form of government. What type of government in the 1960s was the government that they wanted to have, even though the Constitution did not guarantee that? A democracy. In other words, this was the beginning of one person, one vote. And the principle coming from the Warren Court in realigning and actually perverting the republics of the state by taking away the county governments and saying you don't have a right to be to have representation. Every person, it's only people that have that right, and they literally threw us into a democracy. And so that you can see how this right here is a part of the progressive agenda. This was the second era of the, or I should say, actually, it's the third. This was the third era of progressivism. The first era of progressivism started in the 1800s when government started going after corporations. They started going after security exchanges, banks, and all those types of things because they wanted to control all these large corporate money laundering entities. And so they seized those controls. The next set was on the social side, which was, you know, right after Coolidge. Hardy and Coolidge created a little cooling off period for the progressive era, even though Harding was probably the worst president we ever had, and he even claimed himself to be the worst president. Now, when I say the worst, because he wasn't in there to do anything good. He was only in there to serve himself. And if you've never read it, he basically said that, you know, he never considered himself worthy of being a president. And how he got into that's kind of it's an interesting story. But we also see how FDR, Obama, we actually have really evil presidents that have done this nation harm. And they've used manipulation and abused the Constitution, getting people to support it. And so
does this mean that the District of Columbia has three electors?
It sure does. And actually, if I remember correctly, its population. So if the Virginia side was still a part of it, they probably would have two seats. They would probably have two electors for the people. In other words, they get two electors for the, like it's a state, and then they would have an elector for its people, like for the House. Mm-hmm. And so I believe if Virginia, the northern part of Virginia, because the Virginia side of D.C. was reclaimed by Virginia. That's why when you actually look at the District of Columbia, it is only the top part of that square. Mm-hmm. Because there is no formal Congress or the Supreme Court or the president's residency. So the residencies and the venues or the buildings where they meet and work was on the Maryland side. And so they decided, okay, well, you know, we're pulling all this back. Yeah, you have needful buildings and you can continue to have needful buildings. You don't need this site. So the reason why is Virginia was a huge landfall in property tax. Because even though they couldn't tax the government buildings and property, there were instantly converted into private property that was in those, you know, like housing developments. I remember I was living in some condos in not the Arlington area, Alexandria, and that would have been a part of that. It was within the Beltway. And those were expensive. Back then, they're probably ultra expensive. These were crappy condos, and they're probably $1 million bill, you know, little condos today, multi-million-dollar probably. Anyway, the fact is, when we look at what DC was doing, what it was capable of doing, it was actually creating a competition, and it was creating a hostile relationship regarding the Constitution. Because it wasn't to be an equal party. It was not to be able to vote because right. Now you actually, because let's go down to the next one. So the next one that I wanted to do was the non-operative, and it was in 1978. And this one is to actually, it's after, or actually right before the 27th Amendment. So this is the one that was proposed in 1978 and it expired unratified in 1985. Mm-hmm. Okay. And this one was the purpose of actually making the District of Columbia a seat. In other words, mm-hmm. The camel got its nose in the tent with that First Amendment of allowing them to choose electors. You know, now we kind of feel like we don't feel good enough about ourselves. We need to become a state so that we can control our federal government. In the ratification debates, they wanted to make sure that no state would have that level of control where they could actually play and manipulate, because bottom line, a state has equal suffrage in the Senate. where now you've created a federal entity and a federal appointment of people actually having votes to help move your treaties and the legislation that you want to inflict upon the states. We've actually allowed, I'll just say, we've allowed the genie out of the bottle by trying to recognize that the land and the people that live there, who went there because they wanted to have the assurance of employment, the insurance of a stable housing market, whatever, for whatever reason, they decided to make a permanent residency in the District of Columbia. The consequences of that means you do not get suffrage in anything other than the government of the District of Columbia, which is like a foreign land. It's not foreign to the Union, but it is the, it's foreign land to the states and the foreign to the sovereignty and power of the states.
Right.
So, anyway, so go ahead and let's read this.
So this is the one that expired in 1985?
Yep, that's one. Okay. Correct.
For purposes of representation in the Congress, election of the president and vice president, in Article 5 of this Constitution, the district constituting the seat of government of the United States shall be treated as though it were a state.
Okay, Section 2.
The exercise of the rights and powers conferred under this article shall be by the people of the district constituting the seat of government and shall be provided by the Congress.
Okay, so again, everything they're trying to do is they're trying to actually give a state, a sovereign state, authority over the federal government, or at least creating a symbiotic puppet that the federal government could control. Go ahead, Section 3.
Section 3. The 23rd Article of Amendment to the Constitution of the United States is hereby repealed.
Okay, because they no longer will have just electors and the ability to vote for the president and the vice president, they now actually will be voting for representatives, senators, and electors. Next one.
This article shall be inoperative unless it shall have been ratified as an amendment to the Constitution by the legislatures of three-fourths of the several states within 7 years from the date of its submission.
Okay, so the thing that they started doing was they were under this impression that if they created an expiration, that it would create the expedite the ratification process. Oh, no, we got to give this to them. We got to do this for them. They did that with the ERA that preceded this, and it failed. But they still thought that adding an expiration would be best. So the few states, and I don't know, you could probably look it up in Wiki, how many states were dumb enough to actually say, oh, yeah, we'll let the federal government be an equal party to the Constitution. But it didn't. And fortunately, it failed. But there is still talk today. And as a matter of fact, before Puerto Rico will ever become a state, the District of Columbia will become a state. They're pushing and pushing and pushing this. And as a matter of fact, they're not going to move this into a convention. And as a matter of fact, one of the things that I honestly think, you know how we have the Amendment Protection Clause in the back end of Article 5? I believe that we need to add to the Amendment Protection Clause, providing that D.C., the District of Columbia, the seat of government, shall never, ever attain any rights or privileges that are afforded to a state, including the elections of the president, vice president, and so forth. In other words, keep D.C. as a no man's land for the Union and not have the ability to manipulate or control, supposedly, the land that the federal government sits on, or our public servants that we send from our states into that state, or into that, you know, that seat of government. So when we look at the exclusive legislation, because D.C. was to have that exclusive legislation, I actually look at the need and why the D.C. needed to have the exclusive legislation. that probably needs to be denned. It needs to be re-examined for containment, because when we look at how they have taken latitude on what we call exclusive legislation for the District of Columbia, they basically create laws and then they think, oh, well, we can do this under exclusive legislation, but nobody understands that anymore. And they just say, well, this is for the union. This is why.
Yeah, right.
This is why all of these acts, like the Civil Rights Act of the 60s, the ADA, the American Disabilities Act, all these different acts that they passed are not applicable to the states. They're only applicable to the District of Columbia and territories, and federal buildings and offices, federal property. And they've used these things as weapons in trying to regulate and say, oh, yeah, you've got to do these things, because we have become so illiterate on the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
One of our nation's greatest problems is its illiteracy. Now, when we look at, because I talked about this on a previous show, it was either on a Feedback Friday or Makeup Monday, but I talked about the downfall of Christianity in America, that I was reading the Pew Research, because I remember when I wrote my first book, or actually before I wrote my first book, I remember in the 1990s, I think it was 96, they did an extensive research on religion in America, and they found that there was like 62% of Americans that identified as Christians. And out of the 62% of America that identified as Christians, less than 50% believed that there was a Satan or a devil. Which means, how could they actually be Christians without, you know, acknowledging that there is a Satan that exists? So as you start looking at how they kind of came up with these numbers, even at that point in time, they had probably less than 50% that were, you know, regularly attending church and, you know, doing things. And it was even less. I think it was something like in the 20s where people were reading scriptures. Today, that is an astronomical. I mean, the numbers are getting lower and lower and lower because of our education system. Our education system has basically gotten people to say that is frivolous information and it's a frivolous document, which is why those who have read the Bible I haven't seen the research lately on this, but I don't think I'm in a stretch to say that's probably less than 10% of America. So what is 10% of America? If we have 300 million people, what's 10% of that? 30 million, right? And I think that that is probably accurate, that it's going to be less than 10%.
I was going to say that's probably high.
It's less than. So it's 30 million or less. And I would think that it's probably, you know, 5% maybe. Maybe even less than that. And as a matter of fact, for the people who have read the Bible from cover to cover, is easily probably less than
1%. Yeah, for sure.
So As we look at how we've become so illiterate on the Constitution, we've also been equally illiterate on Christianity and those principles that are entwined with liberty. Because Christianity is one of the very few religions that really, I mean, I think there's Hindu, Buddhism, there are some religions out there that don't profess to, you know, to necessarily live a very specific way and so forth, but they do have, and they have an appeal of liberty where you don't conscript people to doing, you know, you have to do these things like Islam. And so when we look at the cause of liberty and how liberty is integral, it is, you know, an undeniable part of Christianity, where people have to learn for themselves. It's kind of like the water and the horse thing. You can lead the horse to the water, you can't make him drink. You can lead the people to the Bible, you can lead them to the scriptures, you can lead them to Christ, but you can't make them accept him. That has to happen on their own. That you, if you teach, because if we look at the problems of Christianity in Europe and the religious wars that were occurring, I mean, they were literally taking Christianity to a whole new totalitarian view. You know, this is the only church and everything. I mean, even Christ would not have, you know, called for the, in the New Testament, he would not have called for the elimination of people that were trying to follow him. He, as a matter of fact, those who were sinners under the Mosaic law, the adulterer, was told, go and repent and sin no more. Though you have the liberty to continue in your sin, go and sin no more. And so this was this whole new covenant that came from Christ was this one that was, again, integral. Liberty was integral to his plan. People had to choose. And so America was built that way, and it was built on these concepts that actually allowed it to flourish with a free economy, with the freedom of religion, and so forth. And as we flourished, we grew, and we were blessed. And as we continued to grow, we started getting taken over by evildoers in dark rooms, and they started creating conspiracies. And next thing you know, they have grown their conspiracies to actually have enough people that are just, they're automatons. There are a whole bunch of people out there that just do what they're told. As a matter of fact, the kids in school today are told how to find, you know, how not to vote, because, you know, there are plenty of sites out there that actually brag about, we believe we vote. These are the Christians. We do these religious tests, and these are the people to vote for. And so the kids, their teachers say, okay, look at who they're supporting. And there's no doubt in my mind that, that politics is permeating into the school, and that these teachers are literally weaponizing our children. I mean, our kids are not smart enough to come up with this idea of giving up guns and giving up our liberties and those types of things. Embracing damaging paradigms of, you know, sexual dysphoria and critical race theory and this guilt baiting of how dare you be a white, you know, American and have, you know, any rights of property. How dare you? To be able to enjoy this country, you need to surrender it to all these other people. And that's the design. That is their design.
Well, now it's gone even as far as how dare you believe that there's only two sexes.
That is true. And they're literally, I mean, they're mocking God and they're mocking America and its fundamental principles. We're basically almost out of time. So when we come back tomorrow, what we'll do is we're going to dive into the Kentucky resolutions first, and then we're going to go back into, because we already covered them, but I want to go through the highlights, and then we'll go through the highlights of the Virginia resolutions. Then we'll actually cover what we haven't covered, which is the Kentucky resolutions of 1799 and the other two documents that we've still got to cover. So when we come back tomorrow, we will be diving into the resolutions. This concludes the coverage of the Constitution and diving into it. God bless, folks. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process,
process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.